All right, I want you to picture something for me, something really simple.
Okay.
You're baking a cake, you mix the batter, you put it in the oven, you set a timer.
Right.
You expect that whole process to finish, don't you? You expect the batter to become a cake.
Of course. I mean, it would be pretty weird if it didn't. We're used to reactions running their course until they hit, a stable balance, equilibrium.
Exactly. But today, we are diving into a deep mystery where a process doesn't finish what it starts. It's this phenomenon in metallurgy called the incomplete bainite reaction.
Ah, yes.
And honestly, the source material for this, a huge paper from 1981 by HKDH Badaccia, it reads less like a science report and more like a detective story.
It really is. It's about why a reaction just gives up. And this paper is a classic because it dives right into a massive debate about how atoms actually move around inside solid steel.
A debate that, let's be honest, got pretty heated.
Oh, absolutely. The academic equivalent of a street fight, all hidden in the discussion sections of journals. This was the peak of the mechanism wars.
So our mission today is to figure out why this reaction just stops, what it tells us about how metals work, and how a truly wild experiment involving a 43-day wait revealed the truth.
It's all about patience, precision, and this fundamental battle between two different ways matter can rearrange itself.
Okay, let's set the scene. Padishia is working with a very specific type of steel here.
Right. The paper is looking at a steel alloy with a specific recipe, mostly iron, of course, but also 0.30% carbon and, crucially, 4.08% chromium.
Fe 0.30C 4.08 Cr. Not a catchy name.
No, but that chromium is actually a key witness in this whole investigation.
And the experimental setup is something called an isothermal transformation. What does that actually mean?
It's a pretty standard procedure. First, you heat the sample way up to 1100 degrees Celsius.
Oh, that's hot.
Very hot. And that heat turns the steel structure into something called austenite.
Which is like a blank slate for the metal.
Exactly. It's a uniform structure where all the carbon is just happily dissolved. Then you quickly cool it down to a specific temperature, let's say 478 Celsius, and you just hold it there
Yeah.
and you watch.
And you're expecting that austenite to transform into something else, right? Something called bainite.
Correct. Bainite is a much harder, stronger microstructure. And in theory, we have MAPS phase diagrams that tell us exactly how much bainite should form.
There's a finish line.
There is. It's a line on the chart called the AKP3 curve. That's equilibrium. It tells you the reaction should keep going until the leftover austenite reaches a certain carbon concentration.
So you're watching, you're measuring, the reaction's heading for that finish line, but then the twist happens.
Right. The paper shows that the reaction starts off really fast, bainite is forming, but then way before it gets anywhere near that equilibrium line, it just stops.
It just gives up.
It flatlines. The amount of bainite is limited. The austenite that's left over hasn't reached its target carbon level. It hits this invisible wall.
And that wall is what Padishia calls the T-double weather curve.
Precisely.
So it's like running a marathon. And the finish line is at 26 miles, but all the runners just stop dead at mile 18 for no apparent reason.
That's a fantastic analogy. And they measured this happening using a technique called dilatometry.
Which is just a fancy way of saying they measured its size, right?
Yeah. As austenite turns into bainite, the whole sample gets a tiny bit longer, so you track the length. The graph in the paper is dramatic. It's a steep curve going up, and then a sudden, hard, horizontal line. It's over. And the question is just why?
And that why brings us right into the middle of the mechanism wars.
The core of the controversy.
Because there were two sort of warring factions about how this transformation happens at an atomic level.
Two main camps, yeah. On one side, you had the diffusional theory. On the other, the displacive theory.
Okay, let's break that down. Diffusional.
Think of atoms at a cocktail party.
A cocktail party for atoms. I like it.
In the diffusional model, atoms are just wandering around individually. They mingle, they slowly find new positions, and a new structure forms over time. It's
Yeah.
uncoordinated.
Casual mingling. Got it. So what's the displacive theory?
That's more like a military drill team.
Okay.
The atoms don't wander. A whole group of them moves in unison. A block of the crystal structure shears into a new shape all at once. It's coordinated, it's incredibly fast, and this is the important part, it physically changes the shape of the material.
It creates a physical distortion.
Exactly. It's called an invariant plane strain. Now, Hadashia's argument is that bainite is displacive. It grows by that military shear, but there's a catch.
Nothing is ever free, especially in physics.
Precisely. That shearing motion distorts the crystal lattice, and that creates strain. We call it strain energy. Hideshi argues this acts like a penalty, a tax.
A tax. So the reaction wants to happen, but it has to pay for the privilege.
Yes. The chemical driving force, the urge to transform, has to be strong enough to both build the new structure and pay that strain energy tax. As the reaction goes on, the remaining austenite gets richer in carbon, which reduces the driving force.
And eventually it just can't afford the tax anymore.
That is the invisible wall. That's the T-dollar curve. The reaction stops not because it's finished, but because it's run out of thermodynamic money. It's broke.
That makes a lot of sense. But the other side, the diffusional camp, they wouldn't have that tax, right?
No. Diffusion is stress-free. If it were just atoms wandering around, they should just keep wandering until they hit that true equilibrium finish line.
So the fact that it stops is powerful evidence for the displacive idea.
It's strong evidence, but it's not absolute proof. And this is where the paper gets, I think, really brilliant. Because they didn't just stop the experiment there.
They waited.
They turned patience into a scientific instrument.
I mean, the data shows the reaction was done in about 30 minutes. Most people would just call it a day.
But they didn't. They left that steel sample sitting in the furnace at 478 degrees.
How long?
For 43 days.
43 days. That's just, I can't imagine the grant proposal for that. We're going to keep a furnace running for a month and a half to see if anything happens.
It sounds absurd, but it's the whole point. They were asking, okay, the displacive military march is stuck. If we wait long enough, can the slow diffusional cocktail party take over and finish the job?
So what did they find after 43 days?
They pulled the sample out and they put it under a powerful microscope, and the pictures are just, they're the smoking gun.
What do they show?
Okay, so the original bainite plates were these sharp, straight, needle-like features. But after 43 days, the edges of those plates, the interfaces, had grown these little bumps. The paper calls them perturbations.
Bumps. So it looks like it was sprouting things.
Sort of, yeah. And they analyzed those bumps very, very carefully. And they found three critical things.
Okay.
One, the bumps were ferrite, not bainite. Two, their chemical composition was different.
Different how?
Remember that chromium we talked about?
Mm.
In the fast displacive bainite reaction, the chromium atoms don't have time to move. But in these slow-growing bumps, the chromium had moved. It had partitioned.
Which means atoms were wandering around, diffusing.
Yeah. Exactly. And the third thing was that these bumps did not create that military-style shape change that the bainite did.
So let me see if I have this straight. The fast, sharp bainite forms in minutes and then stops cold.
Yep.
But if you wait for over a month, these slow, lumpy, diffusional bumps start to grow off the sides of it.
And that is the proof. That result shows that diffusion can happen at this temperature, but it is unbelievably slow.
So if bainite itself were a diffusional process, it wouldn't have been fast and sharp.
It would have been slow and lumpy from the start. It would have involved chromium moving around, and it would have just kept on going slowly towards equilibrium. It would never have stopped at the T-dollar curve.
The fact that these two things look so different and behave so differently, separated by time,
proves they are two different mechanisms. Bainite is displacive. It stops because of the strain energy. The only way to move forward after that is to switch to a completely different, much slower diffusional process.
It's like the army hits a wall and stops. So they send out a few individual soldiers to try and crawl over it, and it takes them 43 days to move half an inch.
That's a perfect way to put it. The paper notes, the bumps only grew about half a micron in all that time. That's just, it's orders of magnitude slower than the original reaction.
Okay, this feels like an open and shut case. Hideshi presents the evidence. Huh? But science is never that clean.
No, it is not. And that brings us to the discussion section of the paper, which in this case is basically a transcript of the academic smackdown that followed his presentation.
And we have some big names here from the other side. Shiflett, Aronson. These were the main proponents of the diffusional theory.
They were. And they came ready to fight. They raised some serious objections.
What was their first line of attack?
First, they went after the dilatometry. They argued that just measuring the length change isn't precise enough to prove the reaction had completely stopped.
It's not dead, it's just resting argument.
Essentially. Maybe it was just slowing down to an immeasurable crawl. But Fidacia fired back with metallography, you know, the actual microscope pictures that showed nothing changed for days.
And what was their next point?
They pointed to other experiments where the interfaces looked wavy. They said a displacive shear should be a perfectly straight line. A wavy line suggests something more fluid, more diffusional.
Okay, that sounds like a reasonable objection.
It does, but Padescia's rebuttal is just brilliant. He points right back to his 43-day experiment. He basically says, yes, you see wavy interfaces. Those are my bumps. Those are the perturbations.
Ah, so they're confusing the after effect with the main event.
Exactly. He argues the waviness only appears much later, when diffusion finally has time to do something. The initial fast growth is straight. You can't use the physics of the slow process to describe the fast one.
It's all about the time scale.
It is. And they had one more technical point about dislocations defects in the crystal. They argued that the kind of dislocations you'd need for this military shear have to be glissile, meaning slippery.
Able to move easily.
Right. And the critics said that when they looked in their microscopes, they saw sessile, or stuck, dislocations, so the interface couldn't possibly be moving that way.
In Badacious' defense.
It was subtle. He suggested that what they were seeing might be the debris after the transformation, not the active interface itself, the mess left behind, not the tool that made the mess.
It all comes down to when you take the snapshot.
That's the heart of his defense. The stop is real. The incomplete reaction is real, and the only theory that explains that hard stop is the one involving a mechanical constraint, that strain energy tax.
So why does all this matter? I mean, beyond the academic debate, why should you, our listener, care about the incomplete Bainite reaction?
Because the properties of steel, the material that builds our bridges, our cars, our world, depend entirely on this. How much Bainite you get versus how much austenite is left over determines how strong or tough that steel is.
Right, because that leftover austenite is soft.
It's soft, and it can be unstable. So an engineer designing a critical component needs to know exactly how the final structure will look. If they assume the reaction goes all the way to equilibrium,
they'll get it wrong.
They'll get it dangerously wrong. They'll overestimate the strength. They need to use the real physics, the incomplete reaction governed by the T-dollar Rohr curve, to make safe, reliable predictions.
So understanding why the reaction gives up early is fundamental to engineering.
It's the difference between theory and reality. And there's also a deeper, more philosophical point here about nature itself.
The approach to equilibrium.
Yeah. We think nature always wants to find the lowest energy, most stable state. But this shows that sometimes it just can't get there.
It gets stuck.
It gets locked into a metastable state. The strain it builds up trying to reach perfection actually prevents it from getting there. It settles for a compromise that's good enough, even if it's not ideal.
That sounds surprisingly human.
It really does. You can get locked in by the energy you've already expended.
Okay, so to recap this amazing story, we started with a steel reaction that stops way too early.
It hits an invisible wall called the T-dollar baller curve because it can't afford the strain energy tax required for its military-style displacive transformation.
And Padescia proved it was displacive with an incredibly patient 43-day experiment.
Which revealed that a different, much slower diffusional process eventually shows up in the form of little bumps, proving the two mechanisms are totally distinct.
And we saw that even in the world of metallurgy, the interpretation of a few microscopic lines can lead to a huge scientific battle.
Because those lines tell us the truth about how the world is put together.
Before we sign off, I just want to leave you with one final thought. It's about time. In this experiment, the difference between one mechanism and another was the difference between 30 minutes and 43 days.
It really puts things in perspective.
So when you look at the world around you, a steel beam, a rock, even the device you're listening on, we see it all as static. Finished.
But
or are we just looking at it during its 30-minute pause?
Yeah.
If we could watch that steel beam for a million years, would we start to see those little diffusional bumps growing? Is anything ever really finished? Or is everything just stuck in an incomplete reaction, waiting for enough time to pass to finally complete its journey?
That is a fantastic thought to end on.
Look closely at the world around you. You never know what it's in the middle of becoming. Thanks for joining us.